Breaking news on SportsCenter, the Texans and Deshaun Watson are finalizing a four-year deal worth north of $177 million. So Watson trails only quarterback Patrick Mahomes and his 12-year deal with the Chiefs as the largest in NFL history.
When Deshaun Watson takes the field tomorrow night to kick off the NFL season, it'll be as a college national champion, a two-time Pro Bowler, and now the second highest paid player in the game. Through it all, Watson has remained quiet and reserved, rarely sharing the frustration he has felt at times as a black quarterback in the NFL. Today, a different side of Deshaun Watson, courtesy of ESPN's Tim Kuehn, who sat down with Watson to learn how the Texans quarterback is finding his voice. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Wednesday, September 9th. This is ESPN Daily. Tim Kuehn, thank you for joining me, man.
Hey, Pablo. Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
I want to start our conversation with a moment from your interview with Deshaun Watson for your latest ESPN cover story, because you talked to him in July over Zoom from your home in Northern California, where you are now, and he was 2,000 miles away in Houston. And you asked him this very pointed question. You asked,
what unique challenges does a black quarterback face when deciding to speak up on social issues?
How did Deshaun Watson answer that question?
Well, Pablo, he answered it in two different ways, and two very illustrative ways, I would say. He started by saying, I think you have to watch what you say sometimes.
Honestly, I think you have to watch what you say sometimes.
That was the standard answer. And then he stopped. He looked down as if almost to chastise himself. He slapped his hands on his knees and he said,
honestly, I'm gonna take that back. I feel like, to keep it real with you, I feel like whenever a black quarterback especially speaks up, the outside world sometimes don't think they're educated enough to know what's going on. So in reality, they like, hey y'all, black quarterbacks, shut up. Y'all don't know what y'all talking about.
That switch that he made, taking it from what the outside world would think of him to what he thinks of that, I thought was really indicative of this change that he's made personally in the last, say, 6 months. It was like he's still a work in progress. He's 24 years old. He's a young man. And he still sort of has to remind himself that he's no longer straddling this corporate line that he's had to straddle for 3 years as an NFL quarterback.
Well, let's trace that trajectory then, because in profiling Watson, you traveled to his hometown of Gainesville, Georgia. What did you learn about his upbringing?
He started out in a public housing project called Harrison Square. And if you watch Deshaun play, you'll see the wristbands that have 815 on them. And that is as a homage to 815 Harrison Square, where he started out with his mom and three siblings. Everyone says Deshaun was just this facilitator. He was everyone's friend. He had this charisma about him where he would bring other people along just because he was confident in how good he was. He had been developing as a phenomenal athlete, not just a football player, but he was a great basketball player. And Deshaun was just had this ability. He could do whatever he wanted, even at that age. He would always pass the ball. He would always pick the kid at the end of the line and bring him on his team. He just had that welcoming personality, and he was not boastful. He was quietly confident, and he became the star of Gainesville, Georgia, winning a state championship in football and taking his basketball team to the Final Four. From the outside, it appears that he had sort of a gilded life.
We always thought positive. We always, you know, anything, any adversity or negative stuff that hit us, we always made sure that, you know, we learn from it real quick, and then we turn the page and keep it pushing and keep it moving forward.
You've painted this relatively rosy picture of Deshaun Watson's childhood, where he gets celebrated early for being this great athlete. But is there a moment where he realized how his race in particular could impact his life?
He started in high school, actually, Pablo, understanding that he couldn't speak to the media or school administrators or teachers or really people in the white world the same way that he could speak to his friends and his family, that he developed this different way of being socially acceptable. And at Clemson, it became more a part of him. He got to the point where he didn't even have to think about it. He just, when he got into a press conference, he spoke one way. When he went out and got into the locker room with his friends, he spoke another way, knowing that he would not be accepted or seen as this leader that a Power Five conference Clemson quarterback is supposed to be if he was essentially himself the way, let's be honest, a white quarterback can be himself wherever he is.
So this trickles down even to his wardrobe, right? This changes how he strategizes around what he can even wear.
And more importantly, perhaps the way people view what he wears, which is just remarkable to think that a college 20-year-old is being judged when he goes to the White House after they win the national championship. You can see the pictures online. He's wearing a very nice red tie and a blue navy blazer and a white shirt. And he was criticized because his pants were too tight. A year later, after he won the national championship, when he was with the Texans as a rookie, he went back to the national championship game with Clemson and Alabama for the coin toss. He was out at midfield. He was wearing a purple $850 Balenciaga sweatshirt that he had borrowed from DeAndre Hopkins because he had forgotten to pack his outfit. And it was deemed not worthy of a leader. People were looking at this sweatshirt and saying, how could you wear that to this such an important game? And to think of being that scrutinized with everything that you do, for one thing, it has to be tiresome. Secondly, it just has to be such a burden to be, as you said, so aware of every little aspect of your life.
So when Deshaun gets to the Texans, he experiences two relatively public incidents involving race. What were they?
The most obvious one came when he, late in a game against the Titans, they're down 20-17. He ends up throwing the ball to DeAndre Hopkins for a 31-yard gain. Should have thrown it to the end zone, but there was just nothing there.
Watson with 5 seconds. Now he has to throw it. Middle of the field, Hopkins. It's too late. And that'll do it.
Wow. Big mistake by Deshaun Watson. And now the Texans are...
And a superintendent of schools in Texas went on Facebook and said, this is why you can't ever trust a black quarterback in a pivotal moment of the game. Mm. And Deshaun was asked about that.
Deshaun, what do you think about the superintendent 100 miles north of here saying you can't count on a black quarterback?
And he just kind of smiled, gave that sort of coy Deshaun look and said,
that's on him. You know, may peace be with him. I worry about me, so I'm not worried about what he had to say.
That's the whole thing in a nutshell, is that he can't, at the time, find it within himself, in his position, to say what everyone else was thinking, which was that this was unfair, racist, and borderline insane.
The other incident is even crazier in another way, Tim, because it involves the owner of the team.
Lots of tension at Texans camp on Friday. It stemmed from comments from the team's owner, Bob McNair, at NFL meetings last week. During a discussion about player protests against police brutality and other injustices, McNair said, this is a quote, "We can't have the inmates running the prison."
I actually was there in Houston reporting a story on Deshaun when this came out. ESPN's Don Van Natta and Seth Wickersham reported that in an owner's meeting that was in discussion about protests for the national anthem, the kneeling, that whole thing, that Bob McNair said, "We can't have the inmates running the prison." This obviously became a huge topic in the Texans locker room. However, Deshaun refused all comment about it. I actually interviewed him 2 days later, and in the precondition of the interview was that you can't ask him about that.
Wow.
So it was something that was very hurtful to the players in that locker room. And I asked Deshaun about that this time. I said, would your reaction have been different if that happened right now? And without question, just immediately, he just said yes, that it definitely would be. And he expressed some regret that he was silent at that time.
That's a crazy detail, that a precondition was that he could not talk about the thing that he is so passionate about talking about now. But that precondition seems like it came from a sense, an instinct of protecting Deshaun Watson. What was he afraid of? What did he need to be protected from at that point?
Well, I think we only have to look at Colin Kaepernick for that answer. He had to be protected from whatever somebody would decide his punishment would be if he went over the company line. The Colin Kaepernick shadow has been such a factor in a lot of players' willingness to speak up about social justice issues, their willingness to take on their own management of their teams and the league. I feel like the Kaepernick example was used as sort of this sword to hold over these guys' heads. And yes, Deshaun Watson is a better player than Colin Kaepernick was at the time that he was taken out of the league, but I don't think that anyone had real assurances that talent at that time was going to outweigh whatever public relations problem a team thought it might get with a player speaking out.
I mean, that sword, Tim, the threat of it, the gravity of it, it was palpable even as late as January of this year, because Watson was featured on an ESPN Undefeated television special on the black quarterback specifically. And he said this.
For me personally, anything on the air, politics or religion, I stay away.
And that's Why? The safest way to go.
Why? Because they can be a right and a wrong or a yes or a no, but in reality, everyone is going to have their own opinions. So you're fighting a battle that you can't really win.
This is so clearly now a different answer than the one he gave you in your interview with him. Did he address specifically what the precipitating cause of that change was?
I think it can be one name, and it's George Floyd. I really think that changed so many minds, and it made so many people like Deshaun Watson, in and out of sports, not just sports, say something needs to be done. And if I feel repercussions for speaking out about this, it's on you and no longer on me. The egregiousness of that event really caused Deshaun to say, okay, you know, I've been heading this way, I feel this way, I'm gonna say what I feel.
Coming up, how Deshaun Watson has reacted to this moment in history and the changes he's helped bring about at his alma mater.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So, Tim, I want to dive even deeper into Watson's public transformation this year. And I want to do that with a story from your piece. In the 2018 offseason, Deshaun Watson and his private quarterback coach and friend, Quincy Avery, they make this trip to China. What did they see there?
Pablo, they attended a military parade at Tiananmen Square one night. And as they were sitting there watching it, there was a protester who ran out into the middle of the army, started screaming whatever his cause was, whatever his message was. A van showed up, as Quincy Avery told me. They roughed the guy up a little. They threw him in the van, took off like nothing happened. You know, the parade went on. It was just basically that guy never existed. And they had a conversation, Deshaun and Quincy did, about what they had seen and how that man knew that he knew what was in store for him when he made that decision. That really struck them as powerful and as something that kind of lingered in their mind. This is before Deshaun started speaking out, but it was something that really stayed with him. And that vision of that man kind of became a little bit of an inspiration as the events of the past 6 months started to unfold.
Tension building tonight in Minneapolis after an unarmed black man died after being arrested and pinned to the ground by an officer. He can be heard on the video saying, "I can't breathe."
That six-month period touches off with the killing of George Floyd on May 25th of this year. In the immediate aftermath of Floyd's death, what did Deshaun Watson do?
First off, he reached out to the family of George Floyd, knowing that there was going to be a march through the streets of Houston, which was George Floyd's hometown, and he marched with them.
Texans quarterback Deshaun Watson was among those supporting the Floyd family yesterday during the march. He shared a photo of him saying prayers for the Floyd family.
He stood side by side with George Floyd's family marching through the streets of Houston, peacefully protesting. His presence meant a lot to that family, but more than anything, I think it meant a lot to him to be able to not take the spotlight away, but simply march with them, show his compassion, his support, and sort of ease into this new role that he's willing to take on. He did it with purpose, and he did it without question. He said that that was just something that he felt he had to do as a representative of his team and his city.
So that happened relatively quietly, as you alluded to, but soon enough, the volume on Deshaun Watson's voice begins to increase. What else did Deshaun do to demonstrate his desire for change?
Well, Pablo, going back to his time at Clemson, he always had a hard time going into one particular building on campus. So he had some classes in the Honors College. And on that college, the name John C. Calhoun is prominent in the front. John C. Calhoun, who was the 7th Vice President of the United States, was not only pro-slavery, but he was someone who said slavery was actually good for black people. So he took pro-slavery to another level. And Deshaun and DeAndre Hopkins were teammates at Clemson and also had this same idea that they felt like that name did not belong on this building. And DeAndre lent their name to a petition to take that name off that building. And again, we talk about breaking down barriers. Clemson is a place that Deshaun considers his second family. Mm. You know, this Godden Country, Dabo Sweeney world that has been created there, Deshaun is a valued member of it. And for him to turn and say, "Look, you guys are doing this wrong. You need to address this for every Deshaun Watson and DeAndre Hopkins that comes after us," I think took a lot of courage and a lot of, it broke those barriers down. And in the end, that name came down.
It is so crazy, Tim, to contemplate how long traditions like that have lasted. How did he address the change that he directly influenced at Clemson with you?
He discussed it very matter-of-factly and said, you know, this was something that always made me feel uncomfortable. I felt that it needed to come down. There's a statue on campus of Thomas Green Clemson, who is that the college is obviously named after. He was John C. Calhoun's son-in-law, and he was also a slave owner. He actually inherited Calhoun's slaves. And that statue is kind of this iconic thing on campus where before you take a test, you rub it for good luck and you get your picture taken with it after, you know, when you graduate. And Deshaun very pointedly said,
I know for a fact I never seen a black football player take a picture in front of it. I couldn't speak on the other athletes, but I know I didn't see a black football player, at least in my time, we never took a picture there.
There was never a black football player at Clemson that got his picture taken next to that statue in his time there, and he's never known any, you know, before or after. And, you know, it makes you realize just how different people perceive things, and the fact that Deshaun had this in him. He always felt uncomfortable around those things. He's not just coming to these realizations. He's basically just coming to the point where he's ceasing to suppress his voice now. That's done. He is going to speak up for when he sees injustice, and even when it hits close to home, which definitely Clemson qualifies.
Tim, the NFL season starts tomorrow, and the two highest paid players to ever play the game, Patrick Mahomes and Deshaun Watson, are facing off. They're both black quarterbacks in a moment where race is once again at the center of so many different conversations across the country. Does Deshaun Watson look forward to wielding the power that the quarterback position in specific has in American culture?
He does, Pablo, and I think he does because he has lived it internally. He has always felt this pressure to be better and to be different and to put forth an image of himself that will be palatable to the general public. And I think that there is in him this desire to use that person that he is, this dynamic, energetic person, for good. And so I think that Deshaun and Patrick Mahomes, his good friend, they've talked about making a lasting difference and coming together to address these social ills in a more comprehensive way. Again, 24 years old, he doesn't have a master plan in front of him. He just knows that the response he's been getting from what he's been doing has been positive. So maybe that cloud of Kaepernick is slowly dissipating, and these guys are feeling that they can use their power and their voice to affect change.
Tim Kuehn, thank you for tracing this new trajectory of Deshaun Watson with us.
Hey, thank you, Pablo. I appreciate it.
Coming up, the latest place college football coaches are looking for an edge might be putting everyone at a competitive disadvantage.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Here's another story I'd like you to know. Oklahoma football coach Lincoln Riley is just 37 years old, and he's rightfully hailed as a progressive thinker and innovative play caller. But yesterday, when asked about the number of active COVID cases on his team, Riley lapsed into sounding like so many of the coaches that have come before him.
As far as active cases, I think we're to the point now where we're playing games, and obviously any active case or contact trace is going to have game repercussions. And so, you know, just like, you know, we would with an injury, we're not going to, you know, we made the decision to not broadcast that. I know we've been probably the most transparent school in the country up until then, but you don't want to give your team a competitive disadvantage, so we're not going to do that.
This hierarchy of concerns with competitive disadvantage far above transparency has been standard operating procedure in football forever now. And Riley is far from alone in this ancient approach. The rhetoric has simply been retrofitted onto this pandemic, as a staggering number of college coaches are opting to no longer tell the truth about the virus caseload inside their programs. Just last week, ESPN's Paula Levine and Mark Schlabaugh reported that almost half of the 65 schools in the Power Five conferences declined to share the number of positive tests in their program to date, and that 21 of those schools are in the three conferences that plan to play football as soon as this weekend: the SEC, the ACC, and Oklahoma's Big 12. Now, many of these schools cite federal student privacy laws to justify their opacity, and confidentiality is a valuable concern. But it's also valuable to know that legal experts told ESPN that because the requested numbers don't even identify specific students, those laws and those concerns don't actually apply here. The real concern instead seems to be sheer competitive advantage, as Riley put it. And that's not just an advantage over Oklahoma's opponents on the field. Shielding the public from the depth of these numbers also offers an advantage over those critics and scientists who are logically concerned about the Sooners competing during a global pandemic at all. In fact, it seems telling that the last two times Riley offered transparency about his team's positive tests last month, the total number of active cases jumped from 9 to 17. Riley himself had just disclosed that he'd lost all but one person at a major position group on the field. And so now Lincoln Riley and dozens of other coaches like him will be keeping the truth about COVID to themselves from here on out, hiding the highly contagious coronavirus like some normal football injury, as he said yesterday. And therein lies the entire problem. Because sometimes, the solutions of old don't actually solve the problems of right now. And sometimes, having something to hide is the entire problem in the first place. I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.